It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam.
Whenever life begins to crush me, I know I can rely on bandole, garlic, and Mozart.
That's Mario Batali, reading from the work of his friend, the writer Jim Harrison, who was so good at reminding us again and again in his writing that when we talk about food, we talk about life. It's about what we need, or what we want, or what we long for. It's what keeps our cultures beating. And so with that in mind, this week, we'll hear more from Mario about Jim, and we'll look at the women who invented modern food media before anyone called it food media. And I'll talk with Chris Thiele, the host of A Prairie Home Companion, about the complex emotions of food and music. All that this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, a show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. This week, we're looking at what we really talk about when we talk about food. Because, you know, it's never just about what goes between our teeth. Someone who really understood that was the writer Jim Harrison, who died in 2016. Jim might have been most famous for writing Legends of the Fall, but for food nerds, his biggest moment was A Really Big Lunch. That's the title of an essay he wrote for The New Yorker in 2004, detailing the story of, well, a really big lunch. 37 courses, 11 hours, recipes from 17 cookbooks over hundreds of years. It's not ever really surprising to hear someone, really loves food, but as a poet and a novelist, he found deep meaning in his appetites. Mario Batali is also no stranger to the poetry of stuffing your face, and when Harrison came in for dinner at his restaurant Babbo, they became fast friends. Mario sat down with our contributor, Melissa Clark of the New York Times, to talk about Jim Harrison and what food meant for him.
Mario, hi, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Who was Jim Harrison?
Jim Harrison was a complicated fella. He was a Midwesterner. He was a Michigander. He was a somewhat successful but not entirely successful student. He studied in New York. He studied in Michigan. He traveled the world. He was a hunter. He was a fisherman. He was an impassionato of food. He was a fine writer, an excellent poet, a raconteur, a man of many stories, many hats, infinite vision, and one of the most interesting men I've ever met.
And how did you two meet?
He dropped a book off called The Road Home, which subsequently became one of my favorite books of all time, at Babbo when he dropped in for dinner the night that I wasn't there.
Of course.
And I saw it the next morning on the maitre d' stand with a little note. And I said, Jim Harrison was here. Jim Harrison was here. I interrogated everybody. I said, are you sure it was Jim Harrison, the guy that wrote this book? And then I showed him the picture, and he's pretty distinguishable. You don't confuse Jim Harrison for anybody else on the planet. So I wrote a letter to his agent at that time. I said, listen, I don't know how I blew this, but I was obviously not there the only night. It was my only night off that month. And I said, I must meet. And so I somehow got his email. And apparently he doesn't really email, but you can email his assistant and then she will send him a note by fax machine. And then he will longhand his response and fax it back to her. And then she will send it to you in an email. So it's like a 3-day email process. And we met over that. And I said, listen, the next time you come to town, we absolutely simply have to have a meal together.
And you cooked for him?
I cooked for him like 12 or 13 courses, every portion of the animal that you could not possibly find in a grocery store.
And he liked that.
Oh, that's his jam. His jam are the innards, the ears, the lobes, the kidneys. I mean, he's a man who understood the value of the life of a beast. And if you took it, you simply couldn't just eat the pork chops or the steaks. You would eat every bit of it, and in a very European way of looking at it, as opposed to looking at the tripe or the kidneys as the punishment. It was more like there's less of that, so it's the specialty. So he had a flavor for all of the things that smelled a little poopy or barny. Jenny or Yurik, and felt really surprised and delighted when someone would cook them because it was kind of out of fashion when Babo opened.
Can you give us a snapshot of his food writing? How would all of that translate into the onto the page?
Well, he wrote a whole mess of articles for Esquire that eventually became a book called The Raw and the Cooked. And it was just his intense cerebral take on food in a way that attached the mind to the physical desire. He was slightly gluttonous and yet not to the level of anything more graphic than complete triple X porn. Like, he was totally obsessed with food and its preparation, and he cooked a bit at home. He understood the technique, but he really understood the motivation of why cooks cook and the generosity of heart that made a cook such an interesting creature.
Food was also his enemy. He wrote a lot about his aging body and not being able to eat and drink the way he used to.
That was only a recent thing, you know. I mean, he had a slight case of late onset diabetes, so he had to kind of lower himself down. But that was only, I'd say, in the last 10 years. And he lamented it, but that didn't mean that he cut it out completely. I mean, you know, there were times when he would have a salad, but generally 2 or 3 days later, he would have a big chunk of testo, which is the head cheese of the everything north of a pig boiled off its head and then chopped and seasoned and then put back together in a mold.
So he found his balance.
Right. He found his balance.
What are some of the things you learned from him?
Well, probably the most significant thing that I could learn from Jim Harrison is when you walked through the forest or went fishing with him or went hunting with him, he was hyper aware of all of the sounds of nature to the point that he could pinpoint and capture one little kind of bird that you would maybe not even have noticed while you were walking with him, or the way that the brook babbled at a particular kind of outcrop of rocks or going over a log. The way he understood and had all of that audio filed in a way was something so remarkable. And you can hear it. I mean, you can hear when he writes, you can hear his voice in every sentence, but you can also hear his entire audio world, which is a rich, amazing tapestry.
Mario, we'd love to hear you read something from Jim's work. Will you choose something?
I would be delighted. This is a piece called Father-in-Law, presently in A Really Big Lunch. Throughout literature and lower forms of entertainment, the father of the bride is an object of just ridicule. A ditherer with a hopefully ample wallet, sweating on the sidelines while people actually competent in such matters orchestrate the wedding. I recently proved to be no exception whatsoever during the marriage of my younger daughter, Anna, in Livingston, Montana. I had no part in any of the central decisions that made the several-day party implacably smooth, except in the area of food and wine, and even in the matter of food, I deferred somewhat to my older daughter, Jamie, now a novelist. I was mostly the not-very-tiny voice yelling more and more. We had including crab and shrimp from Charles Morgan's Company in Destin, Florida, bread and cheeses from Zingerman's in Ann Arbor, Michigan, including Grafton Cheddar, Comté, Papillon Roquefort, Triple Cream L'Explorateur, Vermont Mountain Cheese Stilton, also roasted Italian olives. I almost forgot Dunn's Irish Salmon and pâtés, including splendid wild mushroom loaf. I almost forgot the oysters and the actual prime Delmonico roasts and the Norwegian poached salmon, the 200 pieces of duck comb feet made by the chef Mark Glass. There were about 100 in for dinner, and another 50 came along later. Somehow they drank 19 cases of wine, not to speak of eating all the food. Years ago, while cooking beef ribs at his house, Jack Nicholson told me that only in the Midwest is overeating still considered an act of heroism. We'll have to throw in Montana, too. Of course, drinking a lot is de rigueur at weddings, except in the dourest confines of yuppiedom. Since it was my sole delegated responsibility, I gave the wine my full, somewhat manic attention, testing 20 or so Côte du Rhône over a year's time in case lots before settling on a Sable Blanc and a Bandol for the red. I'm very good at this sort of tasting compared to my miserable college years. My pratfalls are in the arenas of novel and movie making. The Sablet is quite wonderful, though I drink very little white wine. The Bandol decision was easy, as I've been drinking and serving it for years. I rather like this sturdy, suggestive red with everything, and often with nothing at all. It invariably makes me happy, recalling as it does the primal flavors of sun and earth, rather than light bulbs and supermarkets. It's also affordable if you can withstand the usual nagging of your accountant. Whenever life begins to crush me, I know I can rely on Bandol, garlic, and Mozart. It will also be served in vast quantities at my funeral. The opinion was obviously shared by those at the wedding, the legend of the hollow-legged. I salute the Domaine Tempier. This pleasure in geologic time is no more evanescent than life itself. That's Jim.
That was wonderful. Thank you, Mario.
My pleasure.
That was Mario Batali, chef owner of Eataly, Del Posto, and many other restaurants. Jim Harrison's new posthumous book is A Really Big Lunch. Melissa Clark's new book is Dinner, Changing the Game. And she left us with a recipe we're pretty sure Jim would be into. Find her recipe for jalapeno honey steak at splendidtable.org. So here we are today, you know, talking to people about food on the radio. And we get to cover it from all kinds of angles. Stories and cooking and histories and science and all the rest. Or, you know, you can go out and find fascinating food essays in all kinds of places. Or you can even get a literal PhD in food studies. But back in the 50s and 60s, before we had all this food media everywhere, you'd mostly find food written about in a newspaper section called, pointedly, the women's pages. And I always imagined quote-unquote serious news editors at the time saying that phrase with kind of a sneer. And, you know, with a dash or, you know, half a cup of sexism of my own, I assumed they were just piles of recipes from corporate sponsors and coupons. But Hannah Raskin, a newspaper woman herself, looked into the history of the women's pages and found a much richer story and a few of the fascinating women who edited them. Hannah, so great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So I think I was pretty wrong about what the women's pages were, but can you tell us what they really were and how they started?
Absolutely. A lot of people got the women's pages wrong because a lot of people didn't read them, and by a lot of people, I mean men. And it really, that granted a measure of freedom to the women who edited and wrote for these pages that they really exercised and enjoyed. So you're absolutely right that there were corporate recipes that showed up on those pages. There were also plenty of reader-submitted recipes, recipes from the food editor herself. But you often had a lot of kind of Q&A format. And in that space where, you know, women who were cooking or taking care of their home, they would ask for help with this or help with that. And oftentimes these would become somewhat political discussions. Sometimes they needed help with figuring out how to, you know, find daycare for their kids. Sometimes they needed help with transportation to the supermarket. And a lot of these political issues filtered into what was supposedly a page about food.
What do you mean by they were political issues?
There was plenty of discussion of food stamps and school lunch, you know, issues as to how the government should or should not support farmers. I mean, things that were probably being covered elsewhere, but here they were being covered through the lens of food.
Yeah. And you found the stories and looked into the stories of some of these editors who were doing really interesting stuff.
Absolutely. So there are a number of these women, and I do want to credit Kim Voss, who's an academic who's really started, you know, pulling some of these names from the archives and finding some of their work. What brings them together is really what unifies food writers today. They had tremendous curiosity. They were very courageous. And that courage sometimes came into play in their own workplaces. They had to deal with what was essentially a gender segregated workplace in many cases. They would be sent to a room sometimes on a different floor so that they wouldn't be exposed to the cigar smoke and curse words that personified newsrooms at that time. In a lot of cases, they never got married, either because they were independent and chose not to, or as some of them have since said or did say, the job didn't allow them to. I mean, these were really women who were devoted to their work. So the first woman I really got a chance to familiarize myself with was the woman who held the position I now hold, which is a food editor at the what is now the Post and Courier. It was a different paper at the time. And she was very typical of these women in that she was born in Canada and started, you know, in journalism at a fairly young age, loved it, was just very excited by, you know, the whole prospect of breaking news and communicating with an audience. But her marriage didn't go well, and so she wanted a divorce, which at the time in Canada literally required an act of parliament. So she moved to Reno, gave her a quickie divorce, and met someone there who suggested Charleston. In Charleston, she became food editor at the paper and just flourished. I mean, just, you know, did a wonderful job. Never gave up the Canadian tradition of drinking scotch and ginger ale. Love stories. and kept that food page going for decades.
Yeah. And you also looked into the story of a woman named Eleanor Lee.
Yeah, so Eleanor Lee I came to know when I was doing research into the chef's tournament that was held in Virginia in the late 40s. She was considered then a very authoritative panelist. They had sought her out to lend some expertise to this competition. Eleanor Lee had a radio show first and then ended up becoming the food editor for the Washington Post. And she really was a trailblazer in some of the political stuff. She, like many of her counterparts, did a fantastic job of making women feel okay about making choices in the kitchen, making choices to not be in the kitchen. We look back at a lot of these 1950s, again, women's pages, and we see, you know, a lot of discussion of shortcuts and mixes and things that now seem so at odds with where we are in the fresh, you know, local seasonal food movement. And it's really important to remember that those were the technical advances that gave these women an opportunity to spend a little less time in the kitchen. And when the food editors got behind them, they were getting behind their fellow women.
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting. It sounds like, you know, they were like these super self-empowered women practicing this kind of proto-feminism.
Yeah, absolutely. They absolutely were. Unfortunately, what happened then is in the 1970s, when, you know, feminism becomes a really big movement, some of its leaders did not appreciate all that these women had done and really associated them with keeping women tied to the kitchen. And, you know, and absolutely, if you go through these older food sections, you absolutely see things about pleasing your husband. That is a trope that reoccurs and reoccurs. And so in response to that, a lot of the younger feminist activists really did not want anything to do with these women. And so these women who had been rejected by, you know, by their newsrooms, by their coworkers for years and years and years, although absolutely beloved by their audiences. I mean, these were the confidants for their communities. But they had a tough time in the workplace, and then they weren't any more appreciated by these younger women for what they had done.
Such a fascinating, complicated story. Thanks so much for coming in today, Hannah.
Thank you, Francis.
Hannah Raskin is the food editor and restaurant critic of the Post and Courier in Charleston. Her story on the 1948 Virginia Chef's Tournament that sparked this conversation is in the Southern Foodways Alliance's quarterly Gravy. Coming up, real talk on slow cookers from America's Test Kitchen. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. So I have a theory for why something as simple as a carrot tastes so much better when you're at a fancy restaurant. I mean, sure, the chef may have known that carrot by name, and it may have been harvested by like an actual rocket scientist, but I think so much of it is because when we sit down for that meal, we know how much it costs. And that makes us actually take a moment to really concentrate on the carrot when we eat it, to really taste it. Well, it turns out my theory isn't new, or at least the idea of focusing on food as a mindful practice isn't new. In Japan, there's a long tradition of Buddhist cooking that is all about mindful cooking and eating, to connect yourself to your time and place. Abigail Leonard reports from Tokyo.
I'm here in northeast Tokyo in the bustling Asakusa neighborhood. There are lots of people on bikes and buses whizzing by, and I've heard about a monk in a temple here who specializes in shojin ryori, which is a kind of vegan temple cuisine. So I'm off to find him.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to meet you. This is Monk Kaku Hoeyoi, the chief priest of this 400-year-old Buddhist temple. He leads me into the main sanctuary. It's candlelit, red and gold and lacquer, and the air is heavy with incense. Aoi grew up here, learning to cook from his mother in the temple's small kitchen. He makes shojin ryori, the traditional vegan Buddhist cuisine that spread from China in the 6th century and laid the foundation for modern Japanese cooking. Today, he's making horenthal, a kind of leafy green.
This is a very traditional recipe. So just soy sauce and sugar And sesame is very, very simple.
So simple, in fact, it doesn't use any onions or garlic. No Shojin Ryori cooking does, because, Aoi says, monks found it interfered with chanting sutra.
We will have the same small room and a lot of people. So if we eat a garlic and onion, it smells, stink.
Right, so it's just a sociable thing to do.
Yes.
So what do you use then? What other sorts of strong flavors do you have to work with?
For example, we have ginger, or we have a lot of herbs.
He slices the greens and the whole thing goes in the bowl. Ends, stalks, everything.
Actually, this is edible.
In this tradition, nothing goes to waste. Aoi saves vegetable peelings to make stir fries. The seaweed he used for stock becomes pickles. Every life and every bite is precious.
In the temple, when we eating a food, just concentrate the food. For example, when I bite sesame seeds, maybe sound like pss, pss, pss. So just concentrate in front of you. It's very connected to the meditations.
Aoi wasn't always such an adherent. After college, he resisted his Buddhist birthright and moved to California, a place he'd only heard about in movies. He enrolled in an MBA program and started planning a career in business. But then the Twin Towers fell, and he felt powerless to help.
So I come back to Japan and study about Buddhism. After that, we have a big earthquake, 2011. It was a very big difference between the 9/11.
So that time you felt like you were useful, you could be useful.
Yes.
Now, in a country where population decline is expected to shutter a third of all Buddhist temples, Aoi's congregation is thriving. It's up to 1,000 people, in part because he holds regular dinners and also dining in the dark events, where guests learn to really focus on food by eating blindfolded.
Do you feel like you really found your calling?
Yes. Now I don't have any money. Before becoming a monk, I'm happy because I have a lot of money. I'm happy because I have a girlfriend. But now, I just say I'm happy because I'm just happy.
So is it possible to find that kind of spiritual satisfaction cooking, say, your average weekday dinner? To find out, I visited a Buddhist cooking class. Students at Akasaka Tehran learn to make temple food at home, the old-fashioned way. Instead of using a blender to mix tofu, the teacher coaches them to use a mortar and pestle.
Kamo-san is handling this very well. When you do it right, there's a proper sound you can make with this action.
The teacher, Masami Aseo, who is also a Buddhist priest, says these techniques are central to Shojin Ryori.
The whole point of Zen is to face yourself, and Shojin Ryori shares that idea. You look at the ingredient, focus on it, and I think ultimately that's the same as looking into yourself.
Today's menu includes things like edible chrysanthemum, persimmons, and lotus root.
Shojin Ryori is seasonal food by nature. So the idea is that you're enjoying the season and that you can actually recognize the season by eating it.
The challenge, though, is the limited number of seasonal vegetables. Like, how many ways can you cook a radish? So top Shojin Ryori chefs are masters of improvisation. And one of the best is right across town.
That was the traditional chimes that go off every day in Tokyo at 5 p.m. This restaurant is in an area called Roppongi that's really popular with foreigners.
Sometimes as many as half our dinner guests are non-Japanese. I want to show them Japan's beautiful Buddhist food culture.
Michelin-starred chef Daisuke Nomura opened this restaurant, Sugo, a year and a half ago. The kitchen is gleaming stainless steel. But there are also the telltale signs of traditional temple cooking.
And there are colanders just filled with flower petals here. So there's one bowl that has this really beautiful sort of pale pink flower and another with these long yellow petals.
This is not your grandfather's Shojin Ryori. Nomura's menu borrows from Chinese, French, even pub food. And Sugo recently became one of Tokyo's first restaurants on Uber Eats, the new food delivery service. So now you can eat ancient Buddhist temple cuisine in the comfort of your own home. Don't confuse this for just another vegetarian takeout place, though.
This type of food is certainly good for vegetarians, but there's a difference. In Shojin Ryori, you emphasize other people over yourself. I'm not saying vegetarians are self-centered, but many do it for health reasons or personal ideology. Buddhist cooking is an offering to someone else. That's the guiding principle, and you can taste it in the food.
Abigail Leonard is a Tokyo-based reporter who covers Japanese culture and politics. And by the way, Chef Daisuke Nomura says he hopes to bring that experience to a new restaurant in the U.S. All this month, we're asking you to spread the word about the podcast you love. Think of someone you care about. What podcast would they really love? Hopefully it's ours, but maybe it's a politics podcast or an incessant speculation on football free agency. Tell them about it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to listen to it, show them how. Tell us what you recommended with the hashtag Tripod. That's T-R-Y pod. And thanks for spreading the word. Every week, we check in with the good people at America's Test Kitchen for some hands-on info and advice for making our cooking and eating better. This week, it's the last word on slow cookers. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, sat down with Lisa McManus, ATK's queen of equipment testing.
Hey, Lisa, how are you?
I'm great. Glad to be here.
So you wrote something about slow cookers that I must read aloud because I think you have just captured the fantasy. You wrote, "A slow cooker promises to be a little fantasy grandmother who sits in the kitchen all day cooking for you." That's pretty perfect.
That's pretty true. I think that's what people really want from their slow cooker.
It's the expectation, but alas, it is not always the case.
Yeah, unfortunately not. I mean, if you have the wrong slow cooker or, you know, maybe not the greatest recipe, you can put stuff in there, but it doesn't really come out the way you were hoping.
So tell us what we should be thinking about when we're going to buy a slow cooker.
Well, now we've tested them a number of times, and I just recently updated this with all new models. And basically, what we know we like is a good size capacity of at least 6 quarts.
So bigger is better.
A little bit bigger is better, yeah, because you want to be able to fit a whole recipe in there, and leftovers are great, and 6 quarts is about the right size.
Okay.
And we also like an oval cooker because you can fit larger roasts and things without crowding. And we really like having a glass lid. Believe it or not, there are some that don't have glass lids. You can't really see what's going on in there. And then you're tempted to open it. And every time you open it, you're really losing a lot of heat and slowing down the whole process.
Okay, well, those all make sense. The problem with slow cookers is erratic heat, correct? Is that still the case?
Yeah. One of the things that we found in the past is there'll be hot spots or worse, you know, they just keep heating up until they're boiling. And they boil the heck out of your food, and it's pretty flavorless at the end of the day.
So you took some apart, I heard.
Yes, we tested 8 different models, and I bought a full set of them that I was just going to dismantle. You know, right? I just take them apart. But I really wanted to know, like, why are these different? Because from the outside, they all look kind of similar.
And how do they heat?
Well, the most basic one is a sort of a metal housing on the outside, a ceramic pot that goes inside, a lid on the top. And inside that metal housing, it's usually hollow, but it has one thing in it, which is like a belt that goes around the lower third of the cooker. And that's what's inside your toaster. You know, when you look down your toaster, you see those little glowing wires.
Mm-hmm.
That's wrapped around this belt all the way around the cooker inside that housing. So those are the classic slow cookers with a ceramic insert, mm-hmm. but we found another type. They have a metal insert, which is thin and lightweight. And instead of having that belt of wires that goes around it and heats it up gently from the outside, it sits on a metal hot plate.
Hmm.
And those cooked, understandably, a lot faster. And so what we kept finding in those cases is that we had to really check early. But people like them who can't wrestle with a giant ceramic pot. You know, some of those are like 8 pounds and
wow.
empty.
You know, there are so many with so many settings on it that I don't want to touch it because I have to get out a manual every time I'm going to use my slow cooker. Did you take that into consideration?
We did. A bunch of them were a pain because there's so many buttons and it wasn't a logical mm-hmm. layout on the display. And you'd be thinking, okay, is it on?
Right.
And that's a terrible feeling because we've had ones in the kitchen where you think you've set it. You come back it 4 hours later and nothing
has happened. There is no
dinner. Yeah, right. You go off for the day to work thinking, yay, I'm going to have a nice hot dinner. And there's nothing and you've got spoiled food you have to throw out. And our winner, every time people got to that one, they were like, oh, look at that. Bing, 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 on. And it starts counting down right away. So you can see that it's on.
So which one was the winner?
Our winner was the KitchenAid 6-quart slow cooker with a glass lid. It's about $99. It holds 6 quarts. And here's the other thing. A lot of them that say they're 6 quarts, when we measure the actual capacity, you know, you can't fill it right up to the top. Some of these were 6 quarts. If you filled them right up to the rim and then don't move because something's going to go.
Right.
There was one more that I have to tell you about. It was a smart slow cooker. And
uh-oh.
It used, yeah. It used an app on your phone to control it. And we thought, oh, yay, this is the future. Except it was ridiculous. You had to have the app to see anything. You couldn't walk by and say, oh, I've got 3 hours to go. You had to fire up your phone and check it. And then sometimes it would sort of jump around and you'd think, oh, darn, I just turned it off, you know? That was not a good feeling.
We want a grandmother in the kitchen in that case.
Yeah, you want your grandma there. You know she's going to be there making your dinner. That's what you want. And our winner really gave that to us.
That's great. So mm-hmm. I know you guys are constantly fooling around in the test kitchen. What are some of the more unusual things that you figured out to make in a slow cooker?
We have been able to make the most amazing monkey bread in the slow cooker. It acts as a proofing box, and then it fully cooks the dough. So we take advantage of that warm, moist heat. It's amazing. I mean, this is actually a recipe that's going to be coming out in our new cookbook this fall called The Complete Slow Cooker. And word is already out in the test kitchen. This is good stuff. We also make pad thai in the slow cooker. We braise the pork, and then we use the liquid to cook the noodles. We've made paella. Where we're layering the rice with the chicken and the sausage, and it gives you this amazing dish at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So we can really do a lot of crazy but delicious things in there.
Who needs a grandmother?
Right. She's been replaced, sadly.
She's been replaced. She's off the hook. Hey, Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus is the executive editor of Equipment Testing and Ingredient Tastings at America's Test Kitchen. You can find the details of their slow cooker test as well as a recipe for slow cooker Memphis-style wet ribs at splendidtable.org. Coming up, it is you and me. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, I get to talk with you. Give me a call at 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Facebook or on Twitter or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. So we have Terrence calling in. How you doing, Terrence? What would you like to talk about today?
Well, I was wondering about morels and, well, cooking them real fancifully. I can, you know, butter and garlic is like the extent of my morel wizardry, and they just seem to lose it whenever you get real, you know, god-awful flavors. Beef, is a bit much. Like macaroni and cheese and morels, perfect.
Yeah.
It's weird, but that's a top of the list these days, I hear. And I
totally buy that. Yeah, so, I mean, with morels, you said sort of a key thing, how do you cook them fancy? And there's certainly many, many ways to do that. I've seen very, like, oat preparations of them, and we can talk about a few of those. But to be completely honest with you, I learned about morels when I was living in Michigan, and they're a huge deal there in the season. People get really, really excited about looking for them. And to me, they always are that moment of spring, and they're always about just tasting them. and not trying to do too terribly much to them. So what you said, butter and garlic, I think is fantastic. I actually like them with beef. I think they have a nice like woodsy flavor that goes well with beef, but I can totally see if like what you're saying, if you have maybe too much beef to too little morel, and you know, then that balance kind of tips over a bit. So you could also try the other direction. And I actually really like them with shellfish, with shrimp, or, you know, if you want to spring for some lobster, and just have them sort of simply sauteed alongside shellfish. I think it's really delicious. I've seen them stuffed with like a shrimp mousse and then cooked whole. And it's a fun thing to do, but, you know, it might feel a little frilly. What you do is make sure you get the big ones. You know, obviously you sound like you really know your way around them, so you know to clean them well because a lot of dirt gets in those little honeycomb kind of compartments. But once they're clean, you basically can take some shrimp, maybe some whitefish or scallops, some cream, salt, pepper, and just buzz them up real well in a food processor until it comes almost to a paste. Don't overwork it so it becomes too tacky and too sticky. When you start pureeing proteins like that, it's almost like if you're working a bread dough. It's almost like when you're getting the gluten going. So it'll start to get tough if you keep going like that. But if you do it with a nice amount of cream, it'll keep it nice and soft. And once you get that going, you could throw them in a bottom of a Ziploc bag and kind of squeeze it till it's all in one corner. Use a pair of scissors and snip that corner out and just kind of pipe them into each morel. And what I like to do from there is you can do a little butter. Start them in a little butter just to start getting going. You can do shallots and garlic and maybe add a little bit of vegetable stock or chicken stock, or if you have some, you know, shrimp stock or something like that, just a little bit, and just braise them till they're nice and tender and that shrimp on the inside cooks, and, you know, throw in a little butter in the end, maybe some herbs, and stir it together so it's a nice little sauce, and I think you're pretty good to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my little Pavlovian bell is dinging, man. That's great. That sounds great.
Cool.
Okie doke. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, great
good
to talk to you.
Good luck this spring.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much for talking today.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. So we have Will calling in. Hey, Will, how are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing, Francis?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
I'm calling about a Thai appetizer called Myeon Kum. Don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly.
When
I lived in Thailand, I had it frequently. And I can't find the right kind of leaf in which to wrap the fillings. And I'm wondering if you had any suggestions.
Oh, wow. Where do you live in Thailand?
Chiang Mai.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's in the north. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Yeah. Super jealous. I have some friends who are Thai chefs, and they are always saying, like, oh, you need to come here. And I mean by come here, never leave ever again.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Just go and eat and eat and eat.
Yeah. So actually, for the folks at home, can you describe Myeon Kum and why you love it?
Well, it's lots of little chopped up things, chopped up peanuts, ginger, little dried shrimp, and you put it in a leaf, wrap it up like a little packet, put a little sauce on it, and eat it. And it's just kind of this great, bright, fresh mix of flavors, and it's just a little appetizer.
Yeah, it has this explosion of all these different flavors and textures, and it's like crunchy and chewy and like aromatic, and I love it. And I'm so psyched you're asking about it. So I think it's traditionally made with something called betel leaf, right?
Which betel leaf, like right.
Yeah, it's floral and aromatic herb.
And and I've tried spinach, but that just, it wasn't maybe sturdy enough.
Yeah. So I actually think that you can use lots of different greens. I think originally it was made with tea leaves, funny enough.
Oh.
But I saw a chef named Susan Feniger in L.A. once. She did something I thought was brilliant, which was she took collard greens. And yeah, not the really, really mature ones, because those are a little bit too tough. But any collard green you would use as a salad, tender enough for that. It doesn't have the same flavor, obviously. It's not that same sort of floral flavor, but it has really good sturdiness, and it's like it kind of adds its own chewiness to it, which is another texture to add. And she took a cookie cutter and just started popping circles out of it. You know, it was like a 3-inch circle or whatever, and it was like the perfect size for you to fill with, like you said, like chopped up roasted peanuts, or, you know, finely diced ginger and diced shallots and chilies if you want it. And she actually did this thing too that I don't know if it's traditional, but I thought it was amazing. She took whole limes, like peel and all, and dice those super fine. And I was like, oh, isn't that going to be like too bitter or too sour? And just a piece or two of those in there. And it was just so explosive. It was so great. And you set it all in little bowls, and people can make their own bites. So, like, if you like it more sour, you put in more of the lime. You like more peanuts. You like more of the toasted coconut or more of the dried shrimp. You can do whatever you want.
Right. Excellent. Now, while we're on the topic, do you have any suggestions for making the sauce?
Yeah, the sauce. We haven't even talked about the sauce yet. The sauce is super cool. It's like this really kind of funky, like, fish sauce caramel.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of dab it on and add sweetness and it adds, like, savoriness.
Yeah.
There is a Thai cookbook author. He's not Thai himself. He's, I believe, British-Australian, but he's spent, like, I think 30 or 40 years in Thailand researching Thai cuisine. And in the English language, he's really one of the great authorities. And his name is David Thompson. He has a few books. One of his books, which is totally classic, it's like an encyclopedia. It's just called Thai Food. And I steal lots of stuff from him.
Okay.
So the sauce I would use for this, which is kind of stolen from him, is 1 cup of palm sugar.
Okay.
And then it's very easy. It's 1/4 cup of water, 1/4 cup of fish sauce, and like just shy of 1/4 cup of tamarind juice. And you basically put the four together. I think he has a better technique than this, but you know, in my sort of dumbed down head, I think, okay, you just throw them all together, bring them to a simmer, let it simmer just a little bit so it gets a little bit thickened. You can add mashed up chilies, some of that dried shrimp if you like, some mashed up toasted peanuts or coconut. But that's basically the sauce. And once you sort of let that cool, that becomes your little caramel that you can sort of drizzle on top of each bite.
That's your sauce. Yeah, I think when I've made it in the past, I've been missing that tamarind flavor. So that's a really good suggestion.
Right on.
Well, all right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
All right. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So you know how sometimes when you do something new, you know, the first time around the block works out okay, and you start thinking, hey, this is great, I'm a natural. And then you gear up for round two, and all of a sudden it hits you like, what are you even doing right now? Well, I have reached my second show as the host of The Splendid Table, and I realized I could really use some advice. So I wanted to talk to Chris Thiele. Chris is a genius of a musician, songwriter, and an aspiring master of pasta cacio pepe, which he says after a lifetime of touring is the only dish he knows how to make. But more to the point today, he's the new host of A Prairie Home Companion, taking over last fall as host of the show after 40-some years of Garrison Keillor at the helm. So, Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, man, thank you very much for having me, and congratulations.
Well, thank you. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
This segment could just be 6 minutes of us saying congratulations to each other.
Man, you're doing great. You're doing great.
So I feel like I have a little bit of an easier job than you because Lynn hosted The Splendid Table for only 20-something years, not 40-something. But many people, including me, adore her. And
me.
Yeah. And I don't want to screw this up for you or for me or for her or for anyone else. So do you have any advice for me and what it's like taking over a show from someone who's so beloved?
I did this exact same thing to Trevor Noah, who was on Prairie Home Companion, and who, of course, succeeded Jon Stewart as host of The Daily Show. And so I think what we should call these little segments, I think we should call them How to Succeed at Succeeding.
Yeah.
What do you think? The thing is, I think both of us are, you know, assuming the helm of these programs that have provided people with so much comfort for so long. I did an interview with Garrison where we were sitting on a bench that overlooked the reservoir in Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
And he started drawing a parallel between the show and the reservoir in that he lives very close to the reservoir and goes for a walk every morning around it. And a lot of people do that. And he started talking about how he felt like a lot of people use A Prairie Home Companion for that. And I have used Splendid Table for that for many, many years. And so to me, our real challenge here is how do we maintain the, you know, Garrison's reservoir, our respective versions of that, while of course, you know, trying to make the show our own, because you trying to do this like Lynn did it will result in something that is necessarily second best, because Lynn's Lynn, you're Francis.
Right.
Me trying to host A Prairie Home Companion like Garrison, obviously it's the same situation. I could never be Garrison Keillor. And me trying to do my best Garrison Keillor impression is just not going to be satisfying.
Right.
So that's, I mean, I don't know about any specific advice other than the listening process is very different. You know, you don't buy a ticket. It's just that oftentimes what happens is you're in the car and, you know, it's like, oh, it's Prairie Home Companion time. I'll turn on the radio. That's very different than saying, oh, you know, Prairie Home Companion's in town. I'm going to buy a ticket and go check it out. I think that's been something to get used to. So in a way, the performance is actually more collaborative. You're not performing for them so much as with them, that you're a part of their week.
Yeah.
You've come to them as opposed to them coming to you.
Yeah. This brings me to something you said before, this idea of comfort. You know, it's not just that people are used to Garrison or Lynn and their voices and their perspectives, but there's something about our shows that I think provide a lot of listeners with, you know, a sense of consistency and comfort, to use that word.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also have, you know, real respect for the power of food. And part of what that means to me is that, you know, talking about food isn't always going to be, hey, that's delicious. How do you make that? And certainly the show explores food in a lot of different ways and always has. But, you know, I also feel like food touches on every part of our lives. And, you know, sometimes it tells a story that's a little bit harder to hear. And even though that's still really enriching, it can be, you know, tougher or more complicated. And a few weeks ago, I was listening to your show. And a song really, really struck me. It's the song Falsetto. And here are some of the lyrics. And it's probably less fun to hear me read them than it would be to hear you sing them. But some of the lyrics go, shut up and sing in falsetto. Sing in falsetto, falling from the highest heights, like the ribbons running through your vibey vintage mics. Everything's going great. You should be super psyched. Put the false in falsetto. Let your voice go gentle into this good night. The further it goes up, the faster it can fall in line. You entertainers need to keep the entertainment light. So food and music, I think, are similarly powerful in that they can both do so much to us emotionally. But hearing that lyric, you should be super psyched. And thinking about the privilege I have to do what I love for a living, and part of me, it really made me think about it. Hey, like, do we have a responsibility to just give people an hour, 2 hours of fun?
Like respite.
Yeah.
Like an oasis or sanctuary or something.
Even though in my mind, like I said, food touches every aspect of our lives. And so it's the good, the bad, the complicated, the tense, all that stuff.
Oh, man, sometimes it's inseparable, right? But I man, those are the best questions, the best questions. So in that song, you know, as that very chorus, the first time the chorus appears, it appears right there, and the end of it is everything's going great. Mm-hmm. You should be super psyched. And then the second chorus expands, and that what gets said after can change the meaning. Yeah. But like, so immediately after, everything is going great, you should be super psyched. And there's, you know, some hooks and things. And then all of a sudden, put the false in falsetto, let your voice go gentle into this good night. The further up it goes, the faster it can fall in line. Obviously, now I'm like starting to say, I'm opening my big mouth in the middle of that song. But, you know, the juxtaposition between the two views that are sort of going back and forth during that song, that's, you know, intentionally trying to get this exact kind of conversation started of like, you know, the value of escapism. There is beauty in escapism and just like taking a break so that you have the strength to get to, as Garrison might say, to get up and do what needs to be done after like the 2 hours we have, or you guys have an hour, right? Is that, and then there's also value in having that conversation in the midst of that respite.
That's really interesting. And I think about that. And I recognize like, oh, there is a real responsibility that I have to the listener. And obviously, I've been a writer. I've done other things where it's about – the point of it is about communication. If you write the most beautiful story in the world to you and you don't write it in a way that invites people into it,
yeah,
it's fundamentally worthless, right? you can make something, but the thing only has meaning if there's someone on the other side to make meaning of it.
Oh, oh man, preach. That is, yes, yes.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Chris, and good luck to both of us to figuring it all out.
Right? Oh man, Francis. Well, and let's do it again. We'll talk about food.
Yeah, we'll talk about cacio e pepe next time.
Oh, yes. I want tips. I want tips.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, Francis. Fun.
Shut up and sing in falsetto, sing in falsetto, falling from the highest heights, like the ribbons running through your vibe, vintage mics. Everything is going great, you should be super psyched.
Chris Thiele is the host of A Prairie Home Companion. Well, that's the show for this week. Thank you for listening, and until next time, I wish you good food and good conversation. Lynn is here next week with Mexican chef Enrique Overa. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Ida Mamasu, a woman who escaped the Liberian Civil War and opened the first West African restaurant in Virginia. I pray as I cook, and I sing. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. If you like what you heard here today, subscribe to our podcast. Follow us on Instagram and Pinterest, and as always, you can find information on everything you heard here today at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is J. Lee Jennifer Lukey. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer, and Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.